From the K-Rob Collection, this is Audio Antiques, featuring programs from the golden age of American radio. I'm Ken Robinson. At the age of 25, back in 1927, Charles Lindbergh became an international hero when he made the first nonstop solo flight from New York to Paris. That's even though British aviators John Alcock and Arthur Brown made the first ever nonstop transatlantic flight in June of 1919. Nevertheless, the solo flight by the 25-year-old former airmail pilot was viewed as a tremendous breakthrough for aviation. A huge celebration was held in Washington, D.C. when Lindbergh arrived to meet with government and military leaders. We'll hear live radio coverage of that event next. This message is for all the individuals, businesses, and organizations seeking freedom from costly software licenses. LibreOffice is here to save the day. It's the open source office suite offering you a powerful and versatile package without the hefty price tag. It's time to break free from the chains of expensive computer programs and embrace a world of possibilities. With LibreOffice, you get everything you need to create stunning documents, spreadsheets, presentations, and more. It's compatible with all major file formats, ensuring seamless collaboration with others. Join millions of satisfied users who have made the switch to LibreOffice. Visit LibreOffice.org today and download this incredible suite free of charge with no obligation and no ads. Updates are also free, so you'll always stay ahead of the game. LibreOffice from the Document Foundation.
Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, this is Graham Macklin speaking from the Navy Yard, Washington, D.C. Just a moment ago, the last turn of the propellers of the Memphis brought her close into the dock. In the Navy Yard, there are 25,000 people or so, everybody who could possibly get a pass to get in. And under beautiful skies and also under what seems to be most of the airplanes in the world, the lines of the Memphis are out now. They're on the dock. And the boys are making her fast. Coming around Haynes Point, passing the War College, and finally steaming up amid the blare of guns and bands and the cheers of the thousands on these docks and even across the river on the banks. And the tremendous crowd on the president's yacht, Mayflower, which lies anchored nearby. Above, as this new world hero, this new ambassador of America to all other countries, came in. The sky was black with the planes of the United States of America. First, tearing along at fearful rate in battle formation, and then filing away in all directions, and then finally coming back into battle array again, swinging all over the sky. Probably 50 or more planes. Lindbergh is coming off the bridge now, and the crowd is jamming around the spot where he will leave the ship. He is followed by a number of officers, and well-known citizens. On the dock awaits not only the crowd of us ordinary folks, but the cabinet of the President of the United States, high officials of the Army and of the Navy, all intent on one young boy, an unassuming, quiet boy. They're putting the gangplank in place now for Lindbergh's leaving the boat on which he has returned from Europe after his tremendous triumphs at Paris and elsewhere. They're very beautiful. Floral gift has just been brought and will be presented to Colonel Lindbergh. And now, as he comes off, this new hero, and the cheers go up and the parade begins to leave here, we turn the microphone over to Mr. Phillips Carlin, who is atop of the Washington Monument.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here we are on top of the Washington Monument. Judging from Graham's description down at the dock, they formed the parade very quickly and are leaving the place where he landed. We called the roll before, and I want to explain to you briefly what we're attempting to do. Graham was down at the dock, which is about 5.5 miles from where I'm located in a direct line. I can see the docks, but couldn't see Graham. The Capitol is further to the left of the docks, and on that, a little while ago, I could see Milton J. Cross, who was up on the dome, and we'll take the picture up when the parade swings from Pennsylvania Avenue around, join the Peace Monument gathering, the troops which are gathering there from all points of the city, to form the large parade, which will come up Pennsylvania Avenue, and as they march up Pennsylvania, J.B. Daniels at the Treasury Building will describe it, and after they leave the Treasury Building, I'll pick it up again, and then finally Graham McNamee will have it at the grounds down below me. We are approaching a towering shaft set on the crest, whose grassy slopes are now a mass of insects. We enter a vault-like door greeted by a cool breath of air. Come right in. To your left, please. Sit right down. Sit down on the bench there. We ask, you've been here long, I imagine. Yes, sir. 48 years. Born in 54 or 5. Knew all the presidents. Roosevelt used to walk around at nights with me. What's that? My name? Walter Scott Jones. Yes, sir. Known some important folks I have. Tell you one about Harrison. Good truth, too. Here's the elevator, ladies and gentlemen. Keep in line, please. That's right, to the back. The car's full. The elevator quivers. The stone blocks glide down by us, periodically darkened by carved and dated inscriptions. A minute passes. A gust of cool air greets us as we step onto an iron floor. We are 504 feet above the earth below, the harmonics of all we survey. It's swaying. It's the swaying top of the Washington Monument. A great, inspiring sight below us. A man loses his individuality up here, becoming insects. Mere ducks, dots of white, red, and green, and purple, and orange below. And though infinitesimal individually, he has joined with other thousands of small creatures in order to become a great mass, sizable enough to pay their respects to one whose spirit and name reach around the world, and to one who today stands like a colossus, astride an ocean, feet on two continents, and almost worship of the world. He's worshipped not so much for his achievement as for the spirit behind the deed. and with the deed performed, for his modest acceptance of the honors heaped upon him. The ripple that began in St. Louis some weeks back has been growing until now a huge wave brings him home riding on its crest. With medals his by the score, countries have paid their homage, but he's still our boy who came home watching for his mother's fate. And now I see McNamee beckoning to me from the Navy Yard down there, so we'll just jump 5.5 miles and put you back there.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're again back on the pier at the Navy Yard in Washington. And just as we speak, they're beginning to come off the Memphis. And in a minute, Colonel Lindbergh will again put foot on American soil. The parade of cars is beginning to form on the other side of the pier. And while the moment is tremendously intense, it seems to hold its intensity longer than one would think possible. Every moment, the crowd expects Lindbergh off the ship, but for some reason or other, he hasn't come yet. And they still hold this tremendous excitement. The 19 guns we just listened to for the salute of Secretary Wilbur of the Navy. The entire white uniformed crew of the Memphis is now lined up at attention along the side nearest the dock, awaiting Lindbergh. Lindbergh is coming down the gangplank, walking slowly, his hat in his hand, quietly, dignified, a darn nice boy. His mother is following. She is on the arm of the Secretary of War. And again, we get the salute. Secretary Davis is with the mother of Lindbergh. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll stop this part of the most terrific broadcast I ever took part in. This is Graham McNamee talking from the Navy Yard, turning the microphone over to Mr. Philip Carlin at the top of the monument, or to Mr. Cross, Mr. Milton Cross, as the case may be. Please stand by.
And then the big open, looks like a Pierce Arrow car from here. Can't make out just who's in this yet. I wonder if you can hear the mobs yelling below now. The shouting is becoming more enthusiastic and audible. Surely that must be... Lindy. Yes, sitting in the back of this car with his mother. His hat is off, and his hair is waving in the wind. The White House car is passing directly in front of the Capitol now. And is just about to round the corner of the Capitol grounds. And so if you'll be patient for just a moment, I'll run around to the other side of the microphone where I can get a better view of things. Please stand by just a moment. This is Cross speaking from the dome of the Capitol again. I'm now around the other side of the building. The official White House car with Lindy and his mother is making its way slowly around to the northwest part of the Capitol building. Coming close now to the Peace Monument, where they will follow the procession of sailors and soldiers up Pennsylvania Avenue toward the Washington Monument. The parade already extends up. Well, it seems to me about 10 blocks. From where I'm standing now, three squares away down Delaware Avenue, I can see the magnificent white granite Union Railway Station, and next to that, the new $3 million city post office building. Just below now on the Capitol grounds near the Peace Monument, the military parade under the direction of Brigadier General S.D. Rockenbach is waiting for the command to forward march.
Treasury, I think perhaps from the standpoint of the parade, I have the best vantage point in the city. I'm down lower than the other gentlemen and consequently much warmer. Also, I'm in a point where I'm surrounded by the guests of the Secretary of the Treasury, who are all around the steps of the building and in the boxes and leaning out of the windows. They have, for the first time since the last inauguration, thrown the gardens of the Treasury open to the public to handle the vast crowd. Now, I see coming up historic Pennsylvania Avenue, which has been the place of more famous parades and the ground where more dignitaries have passed through than any other street in the country. Motorcycle policemen followed by an army band. They're passing now under a huge flag which is stretched across Pennsylvania Avenue from the old post office building where a little while earlier there seemed to be a fire. The fire engines went down and there was much smoke. That, however, has cleared away now. I've never seen such an enthusiastic crowd in my life. The people around me, I know, are going to forget everything I've told them and cheer and yell, and then perhaps you won't be able to hear me at all, but you'll hear the cheering, which is the main thing. The hotels and office buildings in the neighborhood are filled with people. The sun is shining very brightly,
at the moment, but the people here have so many umbrellas that it's not particularly getting in my eyes. Now the motorcycle policeman and the car in which the chief of police is seated are right at the turning point, 15th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. I can see all the way down to the Peace Monument, this long parade with their flags flying in the wind, vying with all the flags that are decorating the buildings and the street. Of course, all the streetcars and all traffic has been removed from Pennsylvania Avenue. They're on the right-hand side of the avenue coming up, that is, on my left. First, the motorcycle policemen who have now turned to go into the monument grounds, and then the military organization, cavalry, and then a band, and then the soldiers on foot. The band is playing. They're not quite close enough for me to hear just what they're playing. The crowd here is waiting in rather a sort of hushed anticipation. The cheering, when it does come, will be tremendous because they are packed from the street line back to the buildings as deep as is possible. It's just a riot of colors. Most of the men have removed their coats with the kind permission of the ladies here, and with the assistance of some of them, I've already taken mine off, and we're all waiting for Lindbergh. The Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Mellon, is leaning from one of the windows of his office. The General Andrews, the Prohibition Enforcement Officer, is looking out his windows with his party. And then I see Ogden Mills, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, in his office. Brigadier General Herbert M. Lord and his party are up on the third floor, where are the offices of the Budget Committee. Here comes the band, I think led by Captain Stannard, whom you members of the radio audience have heard so many times, but he is not close enough for me to distinguish him. And now the cheering begins because I can see about five blocks down an automobile which I presume contains Colonel Lindbergh and his mother. Yes, now the hand clapping for the band and the soldiers, that sort of applause which always goes with the parade of any military organization, is commencing. I'm only hoping that the people around me here won't start cheering until I get just about ready to finish. Because as soon as Colonel Lindbergh's party passes around the corner, I'm going to return you to the monument and Mr. Carlin for a further description of his really triumphal progress. They tell me here that never since, I think, Roosevelt's inauguration, have there been so many demands for admittance to the various points of vantage. Received so many invitations, so many insistent demands for space. This would seem to be in line with the receptions that were accorded the Colonel in Paris and in London. The sort of thing that arouses an enthusiasm that almost nothing else can touch. Oh, there are so many soldiers, so many companies. Now here comes another band, another regiment, more flags. I can see where Mr. Cross was, but he's too far away for me to see him. I can see the painted dome of the Capitol right down in back of the beautiful Peace Monument. Here on the Treasury, they've even climbed up around the statue of Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury. General Sherman's statue over in the monument grounds is also well decorated with human beings who seek higher vantage points. We command the entire stretch of the parade from here. It's a magnificent spectacle, of course. Everybody is just waiting to get a look at Colonel Lindbergh. I'm just as anxious as the rest of them to see him, but we have to wait until his car reaches us. I can't even see it now because the beautiful trees that line Pennsylvania Avenue have such heavy foliage that it seems to come down almost to the street. That is, of course, the perspective from this distance. Here on the Treasury grounds, they're all standing up now. They've been seated. The cameramen, moving picture cameramen, and the men who are going to take stills are perched up on ladders and climbing on chairs and standing on the rails that surround the Treasury building. The other band is just turning the corner, going around. And now I see further down another company of, it seems to me, cavalry. More flags, more bands. one or two persons cross the street in between the companies as they always do at parades. So far, the Capitol Police, with the assistance of General Rockenbach's 1,000 men and the Boy Scouts, you mustn't forget the Boy Scouts, they're invaluable. People will do lots of things for a boy that they won't do for a grown man. And they're all maintaining an orderly and decorous crowd. I'm afraid that when Colonel Lindbergh arrives, they won't be so decorous, but let us hope that they will be orderly. There has been no hitch so far. Everything has moved splendidly. And now they're cheering the commanding officer of the regiment that's passing a reviewing stand across from me. I can't see who it is. I'm sorry. As this cavalry is approaching now, they each have the little red banner with the device of the regiment on it, and then the American flag carried with the regimental colors in front. Yet another band, and from the way I can hear the applause, I imagine Colonel Lindbergh is not so far away. I can see way down the avenue now a group of men in white and another band. Perhaps the colonel is still way down that end, and it will be some time before he gets here. I have seen lots of parades in my time. I've never seen one where everybody waited with such expectation for the one central figure as this parade. All the presidents, you know, pass up this avenue on their way to the White House to take the oath of office. All celebrations on holidays are held here mainly. Parades all start here, and we're used to celebrations in Washington. Now, this is a new type of celebration. A young man who has attempted and successfully fulfilled such an astounding feat is being received and accorded the highest honors in the country. But more than that, I should think to him would be the absolute adulation of these crowds of citizens. Marine Band. I saw that they were led by the new leader, Captain Taylor Bronson, who has just had charge of the band, and the applause which you have heard and which you are perhaps still hearing is that which is always accorded to this famous musical organization. Here come the Marines, and in back of the Marines, the sailors. And now when I thought I saw an automobile, it must have been a mirage, because I can't see any at all now. The sailors' band, as the Marine Band, is stretched completely across the road, and when they get within distance, I'm going to turn the microphone around again and see if you can hear the Navy Band. Seems, yes, Lieutenant Charles Benta is leading the Navy Band as always. Now I'm going to turn it around again for the United States Navy Band. And now there's the start of the parade, goes into the monument grounds. I'm going to turn this back to Mr. Phillips Collin from his point of vantage to continue the description.
Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that the President of the United States has arrived in the bandstand, the grandstand right below me here. The national anthem has just been played by the Marine Band, which is stationed down there immediately in front of the rostrum from which President Coolidge will speak. We're now facing the north wind again, and the war forces, the thought struck me, are paying their tribute to a peace hero. The war heroes never received greater homage than this boy, the David who overcame the Goliath of the unknown, the night, and the elements. Nature seemed to welcome a conqueror in whose heart was courageous humility. And it's been said, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth, and the earth is certainly Lindbergh's today. Looking from 504 feet in the air, we see little brown toy soldiers, little black led horses, coming to life. Even the buildings seem to be bowing under the weight of the sightseers, bowing to this Alexander of the air. The slope beneath me is covered with thousands of little spots of pink and blue and purples and reds, whites, blacks, and the troops are filing into the ground in this pot-shaped affair which has been roped off around the stand. There are about 250 photographers on a raised pedestal in front of the president's box. And on each side of the president, we have a small collection of seats. But Mr.
This is Daniel again, ladies and gentlemen, back at the Treasury. And now I can see definitely in back of this regiment of soldiers, the automobile, or the string of automobiles, in the front one of which is seated Colonel Lindbergh. The president has arrived at the monument and awaits him there, and they seem to be making a little bit better time. They have been marching very slowly hitherto. I can see the crowds breaking ranks way down the avenue, but in this vicinity, they're still very controlled and quiet, merely according applause to the various bands as they pass. More policemen have come now and stationed themselves in front of the crowd and in the street. The soldiers immediately preceding the automobile parade are stretched out almost entirely across the street, I suppose, to make more sure of its being kept clean. Now there's a sight. Way down the avenue... These people who are so small that they look almost like ants from this distance are just surging out into the street, just like waves rippling over the sand. That is the effect that one gets from here. It is surging out and following the string of automobiles up the avenue. I imagine that within a little while, they'll all be over in the monument grounds, and it wouldn't surprise me in the least if they all followed Colonel Lindbergh around all the time Washington has the honor of having him in its midst. Now I can hear the cheering down the avenue as he reaches the various points of vantage for the crowd. A patrol wagon with some Marines on the step just passes me and goes on to make more certain of the clear advance for the parade. The automobile in which Colonel Lindbergh is to be found is followed by a regiment or a company of cavalry, mounted troops. They all make a very impressive appearance, particularly when you view a spectacle of this sort from above the ground and looking down at it from a distance. I've just been told that if there's a great deal of cheering, and to let you hear the cheering, and I'm quite sure I should have no choice in the matter, because if this crowd around me starts cheering, I shall probably join with them. It would be useless to try and do anything else, even if one were so inclined. And now, can you hear the cheering? I can hear it from here very plainly now down the... He's about, 2.5 blocks away from me now. A long, single line of automobiles stretching down the middle of the car line. And now they're waving and cheering in back of the parade, breaking ranks and forming a solid phalanx of humanity coming up the avenue in back of Lindbergh. I think sometimes it's much more impressive to see this sort of a parade after the military organizations, who of course are trained in public appearances, to see the crowds surge out into the street and form an impromptu procession of their own. And now they're cheering frantically down there, and it's getting up. So far, the police have restrained them all along the line of march. It's a great credit to the Washington Constabulary and to General Rockenbach's men, and again, not forgetting the Boy Scouts. And now they're cheering again, getting closer and closer. He's about to block away now, and I hope that in a moment he'll be close enough for me to tell you what he looks like to me. They're throwing papers out of the windows of a theater on one side of the street and out of the Willard Hotel on the other, the Washington Hotel. This looks almost like downtown New York during the Armistice Day, when one was lucky if one didn't get hit over the head with a wastebasket thrown by some more enthusiastic than thoughtful person. Oh, way down the avenue, you can't see the street for the huge crowds that have come from the sidewalks and surged forward. And now it seems to me that Colonel Lindbergh, he's taking off his hat and bowing to the crowds, standing up. His mother seems to be still seated. And now I see the policemen and have to push some of the crowd back onto the sidewalk. He's entirely surrounded by cavalry. I hadn't thought that. There's a group of cavalry, and then Colonel Lindbergh's car, and then more cavalry, and then the rest of the parade. And now I can see Mrs. Lindbergh, and as they turn for a minute, I can see Lindy himself, receiving with his usual modest demeanor the plaudits of this huge crowd. Now listen to this cheering. Now, in just a moment, we're going to turn this back over to Mr. Phillips Carlin and the Washington Monument for a further description. Lindbergh's car has turned and is passing into the monument grounds, and now you will hear again Mr. Carlin. Mr. Carlin.
Ladies and gentlemen, this thing is getting me up here, too. The cheering that you heard over the microphone is reaching me through the headphones that I have on. Again, the soldiers have become pygmies, but it seems that the whole city is sending up its applause so that we can hear it even on the top of the Washington Monument. The whistles are going throughout the city, and the crowd is beginning to flock now to the next point of interest, the president's stand, where President Coolidge will bestow a decoration upon Lindbergh. I think that it would be appropriate for us to give Lindbergh three cheers over the country and make it the greatest cheer that ever went up for a boy or a man. I hope that there are 30 million people or 35 million people listening and enjoying this spectacle as best we can give it, as presented by the National Broadcasting Company and 50 associated radio stations reaching from coast to coast, from Canada to Mexico. Graham McNamee is down on the scene now in front of the president's stand, and we shall once more change the people from little insects to grown folks and let you listen to Graham McNamee on the monument grounds 500 feet below me.
This is Graham McNamee speaking from the press box in the just below the reviewing stand, where very shortly President Coolidge will decorate this new hero of the world. President Coolidge took his seat in the reviewing stand about 10 minutes ago and is now waiting for the approach of Colonel Lindbergh.
Everyone on the reviewing stand turns back interestedly
to watch this boy arrive. Everybody in the seats, 150,000 people, are straining their necks and climbing onto anything an inch high to 3 feet high, from a piece of wood to a chair. See if they can't get the first glimpse. Photographers, of course, as usual, are all over the lot. Thousands of them up here. Here's the boy. He's come forward. Unassuming, quiet, a little droop to his shoulders. He's tired out. Very serious and awfully nice. Now, we turn the microphone to the stand, the reviewing stand, where President Coolidge and this boy, Lindbergh, stand quietly together.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
President of the United States speaks.
My fellow countrymen, it was in America that the art of flying of heavier-than-air machines was first developed. As the experiments became successful, the airplane was devoted to practical purposes. It has been adapted to commerce, in the transportation of passengers and mail, and used for national defense by our land and sea forces. Beginning with a limited flying radius, its length has been gradually extended. We have made many flying records. Our army flyers have circumnavigated the globe. One of our Navy men started from California and flew far enough to have reached Hawaii, but being off his course, landed in the water. Another officer of the Navy has flown to the North Pole. Our own country has been traversed from shore to shore in a single flight. It had been apparent for some time that the next great feat of the air would be a continuous flight from the mainland of America to the mainland of Europe. Two courageous Frenchmen made the reverse attempt and passed to a fate that is as yet unknown. Others were speeding their preparations to make the trial, but it remained for an unknown youth to tempt the elements and win. It is the same story of valor and victory by a son of the people. That shines through every page of American history. 25 years ago, there was born in Detroit, Michigan, a boy representing the best traditions of this country, of a stock known for its deeds of adventure and exploration. His father, moved with a desire for public service, was a member of Congress for several times. His mother, who dowered her son with her own modesty and charm. Today, engaged in the vital profession of school teaching, she has permitted neither money nor fame to interfere with her fidelity to her duties. Too young to have enlisted in the World War, her son became a student at one of the big state universities. His interest in aviation led him to an Army aviation school, and in 1925, he was graduated as an airplane pilot. In November 26, he had reached the rank of captain in the Officers Reserve Corps. Making his home in St. Louis, he had joined the 110th Observation Squadron of the Missouri National Guard. Some of his qualities, noted by the Army officers who examined him for promotion, are shown by reports in the files of the Militia Bureau in the War Department as follows. Intelligent, industrious, energetic, dependable, purposeful, alert, quick of reaction, serious, deliberate, frank, modest, congenial, a man of good moral habits and regular in his business transactions. One of the officers expressed his belief that the young man would successfully complete everything he undertakes. This reads like a prophecy. Later, he became connected with the United States Mail Service, where he exhibited marked ability and from which he is now on leave of absence. On a morning just 3 weeks ago yesterday, this wholesome, earnest, fearless, courageous product of America rose into the air from Long Island on a monoplane christened the Spirit of St. Louis in honor of his home and his supporters. It was no haphazard adventure. After months of most careful preparation, supported by a valiant character, driven by an unconquerable will, and inspired by the imagination and the spirit of his Viking ancestors, this reserve officer set wing across the dangerous stretches of the North Atlantic. He was alone. His destination was Paris. 33 hours and 30 minutes later, in the evening of the second day, he landed at his destination on the French flying field of Le Bourget. He had traveled 3,600 miles and established a new and remarkable record. Was a perfect exhibition of art. This country will always remember the way in which he was received by the people of France, by their president, and by their government. It was all the more remarkable because they were mourning the disappearance of their intrepid countrymen who had tried to span the Atlantic on a western flight. Our messenger of peace and goodwill had broken down another barrier of time and space and brought two great peoples into closer communion. In less than a day and a half, he had crossed the ocean over which Columbus had traveled for 69 days and the Pilgrim Fathers for 66 days on their way to the New World. But above all, in showering applause and honor upon this genial, modest American youth, with the naturalness, the simplicity, and the poise of true greatness, France had the opportunity to show clearly her goodwill for America and our people. With like acclaim and evidences of cordial friendship, our ambassador without a portfolio was received by the rulers, the governments, and the peoples of England and Belgium. From other nations came hearty messages of admiration for him and for his country. For these manifold evidences of friendship, we are profoundly grateful. The absence of self-acclaim, the refusal to become commercialized, which has marked the conduct of this sincere and genuine exemplar of fine and noble virtues has endeared him to everyone. He has returned unspoiled. Particularly has it been delightful to have him refer to his airplane as somehow possessing a personality and being equally entitled to credit with himself. For we are proud that in every particular, this silent partner represented American genius and industry. I am told that more than 100 separate companies furnished materials, parts, and service in its construction. And now, my fellow citizens, this young man has returned. He is here. He has brought his unsullied fame home. It is our great privilege to welcome back to his native land, on behalf of his own people, who have a deep affection for him and have been thrilled by his splendid achievement, a colonel of the United States Officers Reserve Corps, an illustrious citizen of our republic, a conqueror of the air and strengthener of the ties which bind us to our sister nations across the sea. And as President of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross as a symbol of appreciation for what he is and what he has done upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
Thank you. On the 21st of May last, I arrived at Le Bourget, Paris. During the week I spent in France, the day in Belgium, and the short period in London and England, the people of France and the people of Europe requested that I bring back to the people of America one message from the people of France and the people of Europe. At every gathering, at every meeting I attended, were the same words. You have seen the affection of the people of France for the people of America demonstrated to you. When you return to your country, take back with you this message from France and Europe to the United States of America. Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, we have just listened to the delightful address of Mr. Coolidge, the President of the United States, regarding Colonel Charles Lindbergh and the presentation of the Distinguished Flying Cross to that young man. Just as the President awarded the cross to this boy, a great flock of homing pigeons was released from under the stand. A very fine effect. Yeah. And now the National Broadcasting Company and associated radio stations who are putting on this program by radio are going to ask you to just listen to the band for a few moments, because particularly this is the first time band music or music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast, which is another epoch. We will listen to the band.
Why not join thousands of stock market traders who make informed decisions thanks to the premium features of FinViz Elite? They receive robust, real-time stock quotes, pre-market and aftermarket data, advanced visualizations, backtesting, along with much more. FinViz Elite has one of the best stock screeners in the business, plus profitability research on 100 technical indicators. FinViz Elite is also packed with 24 years of historical statistics and numerous custom filters to help you sort it all out. Receive email notifications about important events, portfolio changes, and stock ratings, all within an ad-free interface at a price everyone can afford. Get full details about FinViz Elite at krobcollection.com. From the K-Rob Collection, this has been Audio Antiques, a program featuring shows from the golden age of American radio. I'm Ken Robinson, urging you to subscribe to this podcast and to share it with anyone who loves classic broadcasts. Our music is by H Beats. That's H Beats with a Z. Thanks so much for listening.